As I say, we're asking this question tonight then. Did Jesus really rise from the dead? And we've got four Gospels, four accounts, four people who've written their stories saying this really did happen. And I guess just like if anyone you knew came up to you and said, you'll never guess what I've seen, one of the things you'd be thinking about is you'd be weighing up the person telling you. Is this person trustworthy? Do I believe what they're saying? Now, it's something that people often say when they talk about Christianity. People will say, you believe in the Bible even though there's no evidence for it. You believe in Jesus, but faith is the opposite of science, isn't it? Either you have faith or you believe in science. You believe in reason. And actually, if you want to choose faith, fine, it's up to you, but it's just a leap into the dark, isn't it? That's all it is. And so what I want to think about tonight is just to assert that the Christian faith isn't irrational. It's not just about us choosing to bury our heads in the sand and ignore all the other evidence. But actually, it's reasonable. And it's, in fact, it's more than reasonable. It's the most reasonable explanation. When you look at all the evidence around Jesus, about his death and so on, it's the most reasonable thing to conclude. So we're not going to be looking at a particular Bible passage tonight. As I say, we're trying to step back from just going straight to a particular text and asking the question, why should we trust the Bible and these writers at all? And I'm saying it's the most reasonable thing. Now, I'm using the word reasonable deliberately because sometimes people say, I want proof. Give me proof and then I'll believe it. But there's a problem with that. We're not talking here about science or maths. We're dealing with history. So in science, you can do experiments, you can have a hypothesis, you can do the same experiment 100 times, and here's the conclusion. In maths, you can do tests, you can prove things in maths. But this is history. And you can't prove things in quite the same way when it comes to history. Let me give you an example. Did Henry VIII ever get married? Well, you think to yourself, I know a little bit of history. I know he got married, and it wasn't just once. I know he got married 6 times. Okay, prove it. Here's your challenge. Prove to me that Henry VIII got married. What would you do? Please don't go to Wikipedia on your phones and say, well, there's the proof. Please don't Google it. What would you actually do? Because I'm sure you believe it, don't you? You believe he was married 6 times, but how do you actually prove it? Well, you might start by going to historical records from the time, people who were eyewitnesses of these marriages, court records, church records from the marriage. You know, you'd start doing that, but, well, it's very easy for me to push that to one side and just say, well, clearly these people are making it up, aren't they? Maybe it's just a myth fabricated by people who didn't like Henry VIII and they wanted to get in on him. Well, that's possible, isn't it? Maybe everyone did make up these stories about him getting married 6 times. Maybe he was a bachelor. But it's not likely, is it? Weigh up all the evidence. I think we can conclude with a reasonable degree of certainty. The most likely thing is, he did get married, when you look at the evidence. See, we don't ask for proof when it comes to history. We don't ask for proof in the way that we use that word. See, the cathedral over in Paris that went up in flames this week? Did it actually go up in flames? Well, yes, you say yes. Yes, it did, because I've seen the pictures. I've seen it on TV. I saw it happening. I saw people being interviewed who were there at the time. Yeah, but you don't actually know. Maybe there's some big conspiracy theory. You know, yeah, that's true, but it's not likely, is it? We weigh up the evidence and we reach what we think is the most reasonable conclusion. We do that with every other thing. Don't change your standards when it comes to the resurrection. Can I prove it to you? No, in the same way I can't prove to you that Henry VIII ever got married. But I can show you there is good, compelling evidence that it is by far the most reasonable and intellectually helpful conclusion. It's reasonable that Jesus rose from the dead. We have evidence that points us towards that. So what I want to do tonight is I want to give you three strands of evidence from the gospel writers themselves. So when we look at these four people who wrote their accounts of Jesus rising from the dead, I want to look at three strands of evidence that persuade us this is reasonable. Here's the first one. It's their honesty. The honesty of these writers. Is there anyone here who enjoys taking the blame for something they didn't do? Oh, there are some children here tonight. Children, teenagers. Imagine a fire alarm goes off in school and you didn't do it. Would any part of you for a single moment think, well, I'm going to go to head teacher and I'm going to say, it was me? No, you wouldn't take the blame for something you didn't do, would you? Is there anyone here who likes making themselves look stupid in front of other people? We've got one hand coming up. There's always one, isn't there? Thanks. I don't think you really do. We don't actually like doing things that make us look stupid. And we don't like doing things that make us look cowardly in front of other people either, do we? We don't like making ourselves look people who aren't very bright. Now, what you have with these four Gospels is you have four stories written by people about the disciples, about themselves. And do you know what it does? It shows them again and again to be people who were, well, we read that in Luke 24, didn't we? Dull, slow of heart, not very bright, not very brave. And one thing that tells you is, well, they didn't make these things up then, did they? Why would you make up stories where you are cast as really dull and stupid and cowardly? I'll give you some examples. You just go through John's Gospel and you see the same thing again and again. So for example, John 8 verse 27, Jesus tells his disciples who he really is, that he's been sent by God into the world. And it says, they did not understand that he spoke to them of the Father. They didn't understand. They didn't get it. John 10 verse 6, Jesus speaks to them and he says how he's a shepherd and his disciples are like sheep. It says Jesus used this illustration, but they did not understand the things which he spoke to them. John 12 verse 16 is Palm Sunday. Jesus rides on this donkey into Jerusalem, but it says his disciples did not understand these things at first. At John 16 verse 18, Jesus says, in a little while you won't see me, but then a little while longer and you will see me again. And he's talking about how he's going to die, but then he's going to be raised so they'll see him again. But the disciples say, what is this? And he says, a little while. We don't know what he's saying. We looked at John chapter 20 this morning. You've got Peter and John, and they go and see the empty tomb, but then they just go home again. It says, for as yet they did not know the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. John there is casting himself as someone who didn't get it again and again. See, any good historian will say to you that personal embarrassment with the writer themselves is a good gauge of whether the story is true or not, because you wouldn't make up a story that makes yourself look stupid. Again and again, that's what you find with these disciples in the Gospels. You've got Peter. Peter denies three times that he knows Jesus at all. He lets a young girl intimidate him. Well, he's hardly the hero there, is he? He's meant to be a stalwart of the Christian faith. So if it didn't happen, why would you make up that story? If you're trying to spread Christianity, but you're making it up, surely you want Peter to be a hero, not just a source of embarrassment. And we looked at John chapter 20 this morning, we had Mary, the first to the tomb. But she wasn't expecting Jesus to rise from the dead. You've got Thomas, doubting Thomas. Again, not exactly cast as a hero there. Think about the fact that it's women who first discover the empty tomb, that they're the first witnesses. And in first century Palestine, the testimony of women, it just wasn't accepted. can't help but quote someone at the time. This is not a Christian writer at the time. His name is Josephus. He says, "Let not the testimony of women be admitted on account of the boldness of their sex, since it is probable that they may not speak the truth out of hope of gain or fear of punishment." You know, some of the men here might be nodding their heads. Again, this isn't the Bible I'm quoting here, it's just somebody who lived at that time. Women, unfortunately, were not seen as credible witnesses. So if you're going to make up a story and try and persuade everyone it was true, you wouldn't put women as your first witnesses. You wouldn't put the very people who everyone will say, well, we're not going to listen to them, are we? They're not credible witnesses. You'd put men there. It's another one of those things that shows you that this is not made up, because you just wouldn't make a story up in this way. So when you look at the gospel accounts, they have all the hallmarks of honesty. So that's the first point. Honesty. The honesty of the writers. Secondly, history. There's a lot of details here that you just wouldn't expect to see in an unreliable account. And the reason is because they're so easy to challenge. You ever see one of these TV programmes where you've got a murder suspect and they've been hauled into the police station and they're being interviewed? What do the police do? Well, they try and pin them down, don't they? I don't mean physically. I mean, you know, they start asking questions like, where were you at 8:25 p.m. last Thursday night? And where did you go next? And were you with anyone? And what were you wearing? They ask for all the specifics, because liars will try and be vague. You know, if you're trying to make up a story, if you were the person who did the murder, well, you're trying to make up something on the spot. You're trying to avoid being pinned down. And it's also that times, dates and places are easy to check out. You know, the police can check where your mobile phone was at 8:25 p.m. last Thursday. They can look where your car was. They can look at CCTV. They can check out, is your story credible or not? That's why in a made-up account, you rarely have details. You rarely have hard facts. It's why so many myths, I mean literally myths, old myths, they're really vague. Yeah, they start off a long, long time ago. Many, many years ago. Luke's Gospel, as an example, say one example, isn't like that. Luke starts, the very beginning of Luke chapter 1 verse 3, he says, his purpose in writing is to set out an orderly account. He says, I'm going to be a historian. I'm going to set out all the facts for you. And then one of the first things he says is, it all started in the days of King Herod. Not just a long, long time ago in a faraway land. You've got stories here involving real people. He names the places. He gives us the names of the towns where Jesus goes to. We read Luke 24, and even in that chapter, in the resurrection account, you've got details. You've got a group of women, but the women are named. We're told who they actually are. They go to Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. They probably knew where that tomb was. It's a specific tomb. They go there, Luke 24 verse 1, on the first day of the week, early in the morning. Not just at some unidentifiable time. These are all facts and details. We read that account of those two disciples. Where were they? Were they just on a road? It was on a road to Emmaus, about 7 miles away from Jerusalem. Because the point is, all these facts are things that people could refute. Someone could have said, well, I was there by the tomb all morning. No one came. I was with those guys who claimed they were on the road to Emmaus. Actually, they were throwing up all night. They were at home. They never left the house. I was there. When you've got all the facts are ones that can be challenged if they're not actually true. But you know, people didn't do that. Even people who didn't believe in Jesus didn't challenge the facts of the accounts. So for example, Jewish people at the time who rejected Jesus, even when he was working miracles, they didn't just say, well, no, clearly he's just some sort of magician. Clearly he's just, you know, it's all sleight of hand stuff. What they actually said was, well, he's using Satan's power there. That must be what he's doing. They didn't question the facts. They didn't question he really was doing miracles. They just said, well, it must be Satan instead. You can see again and again, Luke is insisting, I'm not writing fiction here. This is history. This is my orderly account with all the facts and details, and you can check them all. People, as he wrote them, would have been able to do just that. There's honesty, and there's history, and thirdly, there's harmony. That harmony between the different gospel writers. Now, that's one of the things that is challenged. So here's one writer who says this: no ingenuity can make the narration of Luke consistent with that of Mark. Mutually contradictory narratives cannot all be true. He's saying, when you look at Mark's story, when you look at Luke's story, you can't put them together. They're just contradicting each other all the time. That's what he's saying. But I think they're mistaken, because what they're looking for is identical stories. But actually, life doesn't work like that. When you think about eyewitness testimony, it just doesn't work in the way he wants it to work. I'll give you an example, we'll try and flesh this out. Imagine you and I go to a hotel. We've been asked to do a write-up for a magazine. So we get a free night at a hotel. Now what will happen is we'll both have our own experience, won't we? I might say, well, the restaurant was busy. And that's because I was sitting over near the bar and everyone was there. And you might write, the restaurant was quite empty. But that's because you entered through the side door from the patio because you were outside and you sat round the corner and you didn't really see most of the people. Well, who's right and who's wrong? Well, we're both right. We're relaying our experiences as we have them. I might meet the hotel owner, Mr. Smith. And I might write in my magazine report, the hotel owner, Mr. Smith, was welcoming and friendly. And you might write in your account about the hotel owners, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Well, hang on, did I get it wrong? Because I only talked about Mr. Smith. Well, no, I only met him. And he referred to himself as the owner. I didn't realise there was another owner. See the point? Each writer is bringing their own perspectives, their own experiences, their own personality. And once you get that, you start to appreciate why each account is different. Not contradictory, but there's different information, different perspectives on the same events. So why is it then that in the account we read about Luke, in Luke's Gospel, there were at least 5 women present at the tomb that Sunday morning? But Mark refers to 3, Matthew talks about 2, and John talks about 1. Now for some people that is just a contradiction. It's not a contradiction. It's just that, clearly there were 5. It's just that some of the other writers only choose to talk about some of them being there. These are complementary accounts. Again, imagine we both check into this hotel at the same time. Mr. Smith says to us, I used to work at the Ritz, but then I got laid off, and then I travelled the world for 3 years, and then I bought this place. Now, your report is for a travel magazine, so you include all the details about Mr. Smith's travelling. You talk about how he's travelled the world, he visits all sorts of amazing places, but you don't include anything else, because that's relevant for your magazine. But my magazine is about young people who are trying to get into the job market, trying to find a new job. So I include the detail he told me about how he was made redundant. And I make the story a little bit more about how actually, look at this guy, he got back on his feet again. He bought this new hotel. Well, the gospel writers, too, have different audiences. So you'd expect them to be bringing out particular things for their audiences. So what you in fact have is harmony between these different writers. Different perspectives, same storyline, same great truth. Jesus, the Son of God, lived and died and rose again. So what we're trying to do is to step back and ask the question, is the Bible trustworthy? Can we actually trust this? Because if we can, then when they tell us about Jesus rising from the dead, we can say, well, okay, if they're telling me it's true, I believe it. And what I'm trying to show you is that they are trustworthy for those three reasons. Now, for the last few minutes, we'll zoom in a little bit on the resurrection. Because, as we've said, that is the big truth that makes all the difference. That is what the Christian faith hangs on or falls apart on. Let's ask just one question about the resurrection. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, what do you think did happen? See, it's very easy to say, well, clearly that's all rubbish, isn't it? Of course he didn't rise from the dead. What a load of rubbish. But my question then for you is, what did happen then? See, every historian would recognise Jesus was a real man who lived in first century Palestine, who walked this earth, and it's clear enough that he died on a cross and that he actually died. Some people suggest, well, maybe he almost died. But then when he was in the tomb, he recovered, he escaped, he appeared to the disciples, and maybe those Roman soldiers, they made a mistake when they confirmed him as being dead. I think people only suggest that when they don't quite realise what was involved with the crucifixion. You know, the whippings that people received before they were actually put on the cross were so severe that plenty of people didn't even survive them. Some people who were put away for crucifixion never actually got on the cross because they were beaten to death. Well, Jesus had that whipping. Then he was put on the cross. And all the things that happened to him, the agony of it, the sword into his side. He's had nails through his hands and feet. Yeah, how are you going to walk after that? You know, to think that then he recovered in a cold, dark tomb, that somehow got past the stone and the soldiers, and then found his way to appear to these disciples because he never really died. It's just not believable. To me, that's so much less reasonable than the truth that these gospel writers tell us about. Even the Jewish leaders, Jesus' enemies, acknowledged that Jesus actually did die. The thing that they were spreading, and it actually mentions it in Matthew 28, the account they spread around was that the disciples took the body. In fact, over 100 years later, that's what they were still saying. So in AD 155, Justin Martyr wrote this. He said, "You have chosen and ordained men throughout all the world to proclaim that his disciples stole him by night from the tomb." Over 100 years later, they're still saying that's what must have happened. So maybe that's it then. Did the disciples somehow manage to get past the guards and hide the body, take it away? Well, here's the problem with that. Many of these disciples went on to suffer and die cruel and painful deaths because they were insistent Jesus really had risen from the dead. And you wouldn't die for something you know you've made up. Nobody dies for what they know is a hoax. People die for things that they've been persuaded by other people about. But nobody dies for a hoax that they themselves have made up. That's crazy. Some people say, well, maybe it was Jesus' enemies who moved the body. But there's a problem with that too. Because they hated the fact that Jesus had risen from the dead. They wanted to put an end to those rumours. That's what they were constantly trying to do. So if they had the body, well, they would have brought it out. They said, here it is, you can stop this whole business of Jesus rising from the dead. And they would have been desperate to do so. Remember Saul travelling around and killing people, chasing after Christians? They were desperate to extinguish Christianity and the resurrection. Some people say, well, maybe they hallucinated. That would explain why they were prepared to die for the cause, after all, wouldn't it? If they hallucinated, then they really did believe what they'd seen, but it was just something they saw, you know, a mirage. The problem with that is mass hallucinations don't exist. We read those verses from the very beginning. Over 500 people at once, in one go, all together, see Jesus. You don't get a hallucination of over 500 people at once. Maybe they saw a ghost. But the authors are insistent that's not what they've seen either. So they tell us things like Jesus picked up a piece of broiled fish. Why'd they tell us it's broiled? Well, just all adds to the detail. This is physical stuff we're talking about. He actually ate a piece of broiled fish. See, these disciples reached this conclusion that Jesus rose from the dead, not because it was their plan all along. In fact, it wasn't even because they were expecting it. We've looked at all those verses. They were not expecting this to happen. Mary goes to the tomb. She goes to grieve for the body, to bring those spices. She didn't think it was going to be empty. These people have reached this conclusion because there is no other logical conclusion to reach. It's because it's where all the evidence points towards, and that's why they record it carefully. It's why they defend it, and it's why they're ready to die, insisting that man really did die and come alive again. So let's go back. We'll close just by asking that. Go right back to the beginning, that question where we started. Is Elvis really dead? You think, well, yeah, he's dead. Well, prove it. Is he really dead? Did Neil Armstrong really land on the moon? Now, if you go online, you can find all sorts of conspiracy theories about these things. And you know what? I can't disprove them to you. I can't prove that Neil Armstrong really did set foot on the moon. And I can't produce concrete evidence that Elvis is dead. But all the evidence points towards it. So I'm confident Elvis isn't alive. And I'm confident people really have walked on the moon. And the same is true of the resurrection. All the evidence points towards it. And that means it's something we can rely on. It's something we can build our lives on. It's a truth we have confidence in. So we approach the Bible as a historical book, and we find it to be convincing. Because our faith as Christians isn't blind faith. We haven't just picked up this book called the Bible and said, just randomly, well, we'll make this our holy book, shall we then? And now we have to defend it at all costs. We come to it as a historical book and we find it completely persuasive and convincing. And that's why we trust it when we read that it says it's God's word. That this is actually God speaking to us. That's how we can trust it. That it shows us Jesus Christ, the Son of God, who loved us, who gave himself for us, who rose again, conquering death and hell, that we can be forgiven, that we can be sure, confident, just as Jesus rose from the dead, so we will too when we die, that we've been saved, ransomed, and forgiven. We can be confident based on what the Bible says. We're going to close our service by singing our last hymn. Number 270. I picked this hymn just because of how it starts. The first line says, I know that my Redeemer lives. What joy the blessed assurance gives. We can say, I know. I know because of the evidence we've been presented with. And we've only looked at a small fraction of that evidence tonight, really. So we'll stand and sing 270.